true Judaism, how it views different subjects, many times you have to go in places that are uncomfortable because of the way you used to believe, etc. So let's start first with page, I told you to go to page 30, but we'll go to page 4. So, in verse 35, which is on page 4, 1435, said, "And to the one to whom the house belongs comes and tells the Kohen, saying, something like a lesion has appeared to me in the house." Read the Targum. "And he who owns the house will come to the priest, saying, there is a plague, as it appears to me, in the house." Okay, His Eminence said he discussed some of this with you. So somebody just, if you don't mind, to fill me in on what His Eminence said to you about that, if you will. Anybody. Nobody?
Well, His Eminence was talking about the house, how he was saying that that we live in a home is something different than a house.
Right.
And he was talking quite a bit about that, about how we got a home versus just a house. So, what else do you have about that?
How things in a home are the things that you're supposed to bear to the community, whether it be furniture or utensils or whatever it may be.
Okay, so if I come to Aron Avadja and I say, Aron Avadja, I'm having a couple of guests this weekend. Can I borrow a table, or can I borrow a chair, or can I borrow some eating utensils, etc.? So Aron Avadja is not really, really close to the community. I'm using you, I hope I don't offend you. So he's not really, really close to the community, and he's like, nah, I don't know. I don't think I want you to borrow my table or my chairs or whatever. So because this gentleman is not associated with and does not associate with the community properly, with the community, it leaves a situation where that every time someone in the community needs something, and if he has it, he you say, "Can I borrow it?" He said, "No, no, I don't want to do that." Okay, so because people are in situations then, even now, in some respects, perhaps it may be a little different now, but this what happens is, and what this particular passage is talking about, is that because this guy has a stingy heart, there are different ways to call it. His Eminence uses a phrase like tight-fisted, someone who is, holds on to their belongings really closely and does not want to let them go. And also there's the idea of a person with an evil eye. Now the evil eye is not someone looking to act immorally in certain senses, but this person, he's very much thinking about, how am I going to make my next dollar? And he's not really concerned with how he's going to get it. And he's earning it or getting his dollar through the community or from within the community. Okay, so if you're, going to sell something to someone in the community, the idea of being in the community is that, we are brothers and sisters, so let's show, charity or kindness, loving kindness to one another. And this man would not be one who has loving kindness towards all of his community, much less those that are on the outside of the community. So for this reason, what happens is that this gentleman has a plague in the wall. And according to the Oral Torah, what has to happen is that the wall has to be taken down. And the wall is taken down and is carried out, as it were, out onto the sidewalk. And then the priest has to come and inspect, etc. And then it has to be put back together. The cost for all of this is by the homeowner. Okay? So it's not, you know, everybody in the neighborhood has to pay because this guy did something wrong. But when he starts to take the wall down, his neighbor, which I guess if you were in the house, the neighbor to the right-hand side of you has to help take the wall down. Why? Why would the guy that lives next, he didn't do anything to deserve to have to take the wall down. He didn't, you know, if this guy was, you know, tight-fisted or stingy or whatever, you know, he wasn't stingy. It was his neighbor that did it. Say it again, please.
Because he's part of the community.
Okay, because he's a part of the community. Okay, because he's a part of the community is absolutely the case. But, you know, this guy lives next door to him, and he could say, well, look, you know, this guy, you know, next door, you know, I knew he wasn't a very good guy. He never shares, he never, and so all of a sudden he starts up with Lashon Hara, and then, you know, he's back into the miraculous leprosy himself because he's been saying negative things about his neighbor. But if he has to help the neighbor take the wall down, he's a little bit less in tune with the idea of saying, look, you know, that guy, I knew something like that was going to happen to him. He's always like, you know. So it really puts us all in the place of understanding that in community, we do have to support one another. And here is also a case very much like what I say. When we look at the number of people that are responsible for the sin of Israel, you would think that, you know, the way many times that the prophets will berate the B'nai Israel, that, you know, the whole community, the whole state is in sin. Every one of them is evil and doing some heinous crime. But I always tell people that the first and second wars that the B'nai Israel fight when they come into Eretz Israel tells the whole story. And the first war was at, of course, Jericho. And you know the story of Jericho. You know, they went around the city, etc. But they did everything in absolute unity. There was no disunity whatsoever. Whatever Aron Yehoshua, his eminence Yehoshua said, whatever he said, that's what we're going to do. And that's exactly what they did. Second war, what happened? We have a battle called Ai. And so, you know, things are not bad to begin with, but then all of a sudden, you know, things are not going good at all. And, you know, we don't have the unanimous victory over them that we had at Jericho. Something's wrong. So when you know that story and you read that story, it tells you quickly that it was the sin of one man that thwarted the entire Jewish nation. Now, in many cases, this is the same way. And so I say that there has to be, number one, a collective unity. And number two, there has to be a collective responsibility or accountability. So what that means is that I am accountable to everyone. and everyone is accountable to me. And that I'm not speaking in the office of Hacham. I'm just saying, as a member of the community, I'm one of the community. Therefore, because I'm one in the community, I have a responsibility to the community to conduct myself appropriately. And if I do not, then I bring shame and difficulties on all of the B'nai Yisrael. Okay?
You're having it?
Yes, ma'am.
I believe that Rabbi talked also about the idea is to restore one's the community so that you cannot have that division and that. And that's the whole reason why the neighbor's supposed to help. And what determines who helps is it's whatever side of the wall.
Yeah.
House, like you said, like if it's the right house, is the neighbor that lives on the right. If it's the left part of the house,
yes,
if one on the left,
yes, absolutely. Well, so you know, this guy, he's been tight-fisted. He's been a stingy fellow, and he doesn't want to join in the community. So now this is like telling him, look, you know, this is what happens when you don't want to join into the community. And, of course, the community in many respects, when we are accountable to the community, it has great rewards. But you sometimes have to cajole people. You would really want to tell them, you know, you belong in the synagogue, get there now. But you can't talk that way with them because, you know, people will get offended. So what do you try to do? You say, come on, let's go to synagogue and let's go to the house and let's say some prayers, etc. So many times you have to be somewhat of a intercessor for people. Especially for us, those of you who've come out of a different way of thinking, and we're still trying to get how we're supposed to tie our shoes figured out. And, you know, how you're supposed to clip your fingernails and things like that. So, you know, everybody needs the support of the rest of the community, because you may have dealt with things that I haven't dealt with, and then I might have dealt with things that you haven't dealt with. And so, you know, Dr. Elisheva and I, we came a long, long road, and for the longest time, we didn't have any guidance. We had friends that were people of some interest, but they weren't people who would tell you, yeah, this is what you're supposed to do, or you can't do this, you can't do that. Keep kosher. Well, how do you keep kosher? What's kosher? It's a big job. Would you do me a favor? Go in there and tell her to turn that down. Go in there and tell her to ask if she turned that down somehow. Let's go to page 30 now. Okay, in the Remes, it said, for the revelation of God's wrath coming from the heavens is against all the wicked and the unjust who are intentionally suppressed the truth. This is because even intimate knowledge of God is evident to them, because God revealed himself among them. From the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, both his everlasting virtuous power and divine majesty, are discerned clearly, being understood in the things made, so that they are without excuse. Because they knew God and they did not honor him as God or give him thanks, but they became vain, futile in their reasoning, and they were unteachable, or their minds are unteachable, their hearts, as it would be in Hebrew, were darkened. Professing wisdom, they acted foolishly, and exchange the glory of the immortal God with the images, idols of corrupted human beings, birds, quadrupeds, and reptiles. Question, who is being talked about and who is being talked to? Nobody wants to jump in and...
I'll defer to Vidy and Marie. No, I'll go since I start. Okay, I'll go. When I read the Nazarene Codicil, I know we typically in this class and what I've learned from Ar HaKamim is that the Gentiles refer to in general all of humanity. But from my understanding, this word Gentile is a code word meant for the 10 tribes of Israel, which came from a place where they were not as close to Hashem. They were in the area of Samaria, not close to Jerusalem.
Correct.
So they were very connected to the nature. They were connected to those things that were that they could touch and see and feel, and so my impression is that this is speaking of the northern tribes, the 10 tribes who were connected to attaching the mediaries, because everything is Hashem.
Right.
So therefore, they understood that birds and other medium were connection to Hashem. So that was my stab at it.
Okay. Historically, what Adon Gabriel said is very accurate, of course. You know, you have the time just after King Shlomo, King Solomon governs all of Israel in unity, but and that in many respects is seen as a golden era for the B'nai Israel. But immediately following this, when his son comes to the throne, they say, don't do like your father, because your father put all these heavy taxes on us, etc. And so he takes the throne and he says, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to tax them twice as much. And so the problem then severs the unity of Israel. And as he said, the northern kingdoms were much more associated with the idea of making a connection to God in some other way. Now, if you have ever been to Israel and you make a trip to Israel, you should always go to Dan. Dan is in the north, the near extreme north, and it's a very interesting place. There is a place there where Abraham walked through the gates of that particular city. But when you come around to a particular point, you see that there's this large aluminum frame there. And this large aluminum frame that is there represents the size of the altar that was there. So you have an altar that is separate from the altar in Jerusalem, the temple in Jerusalem and its altar. And instead of having no, quote, gods, they have bulls. They have gigantic bulls that are there. And here, you know, you should be hearing the idea of the sin of the golden calf all over, because this is the same thing that they have. So this is you can say the northern tribes, and you can refer to them in some respects as Gentiles. But I think I mentioned to many of you that, and I think that the idea is that And I can draw this from the period of the Holocaust, but then you can extrapolate that and figure it out throughout all of Jewish history. And that is that right at the turn of the century, right at the turn of 1900, just prior, just a little bit, Jews began to have the question, especially Jews in America, but not strictly America, they started to ask the question of whether they should assimilate and whether they should fit into this new world and be, you know, like, you know, Joe Smith, the guy next door. And so some groups came to the place, they said, yeah, we're going to assimilate with the Gentiles. And in essence, that meant that they were not going to, you were not going to be able to differentiate between the Gentile and the Jew. Now, others wanted to keep a more conservative side, but they still didn't want to stand out as Jews when everyone else was Gentiles. So I said that because these Jewish people said, we don't want to be Jewish anymore. And they wanted to be Gentiles, or, you know, live with the Gentiles and not be associated with being Jewish. The God punished those generations that were closely associated with that particular point in time. And of course, then we know that this is the great final solution, as Hitler tried to call it and name it and proceed with it. And millions upon millions of Jews were killed in the different mechanisms because they said, we don't want to be Jewish anymore. We want to be Gentiles. So you have now a situation with 6 million Jews that have been exterminated, and you have souls that God has intended that they should be Jewish, and they should be deposited in a Jewish body that came from a Jewish parents. So he doesn't have enough Jewish bodies and souls, or he has plenty of souls, but he doesn't have enough Jewish bodies to put all of these Jewish souls into. So what does he do? His Eminence Rabbi Ovadia said this. I said it later than he did, but I did not know that he said it. But he said what God did was he deposited many of the Jewish souls into Gentile bodies. Now, listen to what happened. The Jews said, we don't want to be Jewish. We want to assimilate. So, speaking to all of you in the congregation here, in this setting here, you know that inside of yourself has been in this burning desire to be Jewish. Why? Because you received a Jewish soul, the Nefesh Yehudi. Now, the most interesting thing about this situation is that the Jewish soul that has been deposited in all of you says, no, I don't, I have to keep kosher. I can't do that. I have to keep Shabbat. I have to. And so it's one of those situations where the soul, the Jewish soul, thought, no, we don't want to be Jewish. And now we put you into Gentile bodies, and what do? You start complaining because you've been put in a Jewish, Gentile body, and you want to be Jewish. Now, in some respects, this is a little bit of the situation with the B'nai Israel in the first exile. And in the first exile, of course, they're carried into Babylon. But we know from history that the northern kingdoms are not supposed to have, at least in unity, they did not return to Eretz Israel. There may have been some of those that did and some that's not. And then, as Don Gabriel was saying, they've actually been scattered all over the world. This is actually very interesting. A few weeks ago, we said that some were actually chosen to be born into exile. It's not that they were unlucky. That was their meter. That was their measure in life. They had to be. God intended that they were born in exile. So hopefully what you see and you understand about the exile and them being in exile and having this Jewish soul is that God lets them live in exile, but the whole reason for exile is only to cause them to return to Judaism and to Eretz Israel. Okay? So when you look here, for example, on page 32, the final words, birds, quadrupeds, reptiles, etc., they corrupted all of these things. My mind went to this bull that was to be sacrificed to, not God, the bull. They sacrificed to the bull in Dan on this altar. And so they had gone so very far away from Hashem in this count. Now, one thing I have highlighted here is the everlasting virtuous power. Everybody see that?
Yes, Shannon.
I'm thinking in silence, not out loud. I have taken the habit of translating a word that you probably are familiar with, and I translate it like this, virtuous power. In this case, it says that it's everlasting, and then it uses the word dunamis. And you probably are familiar with that word somewhat from your previous heritage. Dunamis is a like dynamite. It has this explosive, violent power, and it can do many things. And it is within the idea. The idea of dunamis is that it has the ability or the power to do something. I translate this word, virtuous power, for one basic reason, and that is those of you who will remember the woman who had an issue of blood, the events that surround that period are, that particular time frame are at Passover, Pesach. And the readings there have to do with the readings where we read that the Son of Righteousness would arise and he would have healings in his wings. And of course it's the S-U-N, not the S-O-N. But the healing in his wings is the kanaf or the tzitzit. And so the woman knew, and she knew that the son would be in association with Messiah. She must have undoubtedly believed that Yeshua was Messiah. I believed she probably had not spent too much time after reading that passage that she decided to hunt Yeshua down and know that if she could just touch the fringes of his garment that she would receive her healing. And that's exactly what happened. But Yeshua said what? Now, he says in the King James, he said, virtue went out of me. But the Greek word here that is used in Mark 5 is dunamis. It's the same word here as dynamite. He said this dynamic power went out of me. But the reason it says virtue is because we know that immediately when this woman touches his garment that he becomes ceremonially unclean. So his virtue has gone out of him. So he's not virtuous, if you will. He's not in a state of ritual purity. So he does not, he's not in sin by any means. And people sometimes don't understand how to interpret that. But he's not in sin. He's just ritually impure. He's come in contact with something that actually in this case, of course, was not his fault. And so he has to go, he has to wait till evening, then he has to go to the mikveh, and then after he's gone to the mikveh, then he is considered ritually pure. But the King James is very true to the idea of virtue has gone out of me, or my spiritual cleanliness or ritual cleanliness has gone out of me. So I generally translate this as virtuous power, okay? Questions or comments before we go on?
Jimenez, I have a question. I want your opinion on it. In Hosea, the second chapter, I believe it's verse 2:15 or 2:18, I can't remember. But here it says, In that day I will make a covenant with the birds of the field, with the birds of the air, the creeping and crawling things, and the fowl of the air. With the fowl of the air, the creeping and crawling things, and the four-footed beast. I believe is what it says.
What chapter was it again? Two and...
It's Hosea chapter 2. I believe it's verse 18. It may be...
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
It says, in that day I will make a new covenant, or I will make a covenant, the four-footed beast, the creeping and crawling things, and the fowl of the air. Is this referring to the northern kingdom? These are the same words that Kepha spoke in Acts chapter 10.
Well, if you pick up at verse 19, he said, I will betroth you to me forever. We know that that betrothal is the B'nai Israel. Okay? So, when I say that, I'm saying that even if it is the northern tribes, it's still B'nai Israel, right? I know there's a lot of different ways that all of that is talked about in different circles, but basically when we talk about this covenant being like this, the betrothal, it has to be the children of Israel, whether it's the 10 tribes or the 2 tribes or however it comes out. So the idea, I'm not sure exactly how this this covenant works out with the birds of the field, etc., other than at some point in the battle that takes place in the Jezreel Valley, if you go on down to verse 22, it talks about how much blood will flow through that place. And I'm sure you know that it's supposed to come to like the horse's bridle or whatever. So I would say that it's not outside of the possibility here that this is one of the ways that Hashem is going to draw back the 10 northern tribes again because of verse 19, excuse me, because he's going to betroth. And we know that the betrothal, even though a lot of people, well, we won't go there, they say that that's not what that is, but that's what that is. Okay. Now let's do something. I was going to go to page 31, but let's go to Acts chapter 15. I did not bring my translation, but I just want to point out one thing, and then we'll try to make some observations. And I will reserve the right to change my mind after I complete my research. Okay, so understand that I'm in the process of doing some research on a couple of different things, as well as trying to prepare for James, as well as trying to pray, prepare for the pastorals, as well as, yeah, you got it. Okay, in 15, you know that this is the case. I don't remember the... the verse I want to read is verse 19, but I was looking for the place where... okay, go to verse 10 first. Now therefore, why do you test God by putting a yoke on the neck of the disciples, which neither our fathers nor we were able to bear? Without understanding this verse aright, you miss the context of everything that is being said in this particular chapter. Okay? So, who has the unbearable yoke put on them? Says clearly.
You mean it's the disciples?
Absolutely. Says it clearly. The disciples. Mm-hmm. So what unbearable yoke could you put on a Jew? And they're Jewish, right? I mean, they're followers of His Majesty Yeshua. And so it said that what you're trying to do is put an unbearable yoke on us, the Talmudim. This is not a yoke this is constantly being misread to say that it's being put on the Gentiles that they're talking to. So let's don't put this yoke on them because we have not been able to bear it. That is not the context. So I take Aron Gabriel and I say, Aron Gabriel, I got a couple of Gentile friends that I need to have a place for them to stay a night or two. Can you let them, you know, stay in a spare room somewhere or whatever? So Don Gabriel says, yeah, he said, I can handle them for a couple days. So, you know, the first thing they do is they come from Walmart with, you know, a pork roast. They are ready for, you know, their dinner. That's what they eat. And so they drag it in and they try to put it in Aron Gabriel's frying pan. And all of a sudden, Aron Gabriel's ready to pull out the hair that he does have. But you see what happens now is it's Aron Gabriel's whole world is put in a whirlwind because he's trying to keep these Gentiles from doing all this strange business in his home. And it's the same for the Talmudim. The Talmudim, if you convert a soul and you teach him how to live, then it's not a problem. But if you get this guy and he's not, you know, he won't live as a Jew in the Jewish home, then you have trouble. And this is the unbearable yoke. The unbearable yoke has nothing to do with bringing the commandments on top of other Gentiles. Nothing to do with that. And let's put it this way. If you were a Gentile in Eretz Israel in the first century, what would you have expected? You would not have expected to go to a Jew's house with your pork sandwich. It's not going to happen. And BLTs was out of the question. Just that it wasn't even going to be considered. Okay, so let's understand that they're saying that the unbearable yoke is that which is being put on us because we cannot have Gentiles in our home disrupting without the appropriate amount of education, etc. Okay? Now, I say... one of the things that we should remember is what Yaakov did, what Jacob did. And Jacob, very close to the time that they're going to go into Mitzrayim, to Egypt, what does he do? He sends his son, Yehuda, there to set up a Beit Midrash, a house of study. Because the Jewish people can't live in a place where there's no Torah. And if the Torah says you can't eat, you know, this particular quadruped, then you can't eat it. And so if the Gentile comes along and he wants to eat it, guess what? This is a problem that we cannot bear. Okay, now go to 19. Now you should know that this is... James speaking, Yaakov, Yeshua's brother. Therefore I judge that we should not trouble those from among the Gentiles who are turning to God. But we write, and he goes down the list, and the list, you can look on His Eminence's webpage at the seven laws, etc., and he'll give you information at this. But I want you to see something here. Who is being discussed? The Gentiles who are turning toward God. Okay? It is not Gentiles who are being forced to turn to God, but Gentiles who of their own volition are saying, we want to become Jewish. Now, if you go back to chapter 10 of Acts, you will find out that, you know, here's Cornelius. He undoubtedly has been going to the synagogue. He didn't have, you know, a Books a Million next door and go over there and buy a, you know, a Jewish siddur and know that he should say this prayer. And even if he did buy a siddur, did he know how to use it? How many of you, the first day you got a siddur in your hand, knew exactly what to do with it? So you needed instruction, right? And the Jewish people would instruct, especially in the synagogue. And if you went to the synagogue, you would know which prayers you're supposed to pray. You may not know it for the first 2 or 3 weeks, but after a while, you start to get you know, the understanding of it. I went to a synagogue in Tiberias, a Sephard synagogue, and... it was amazing they even let us in the synagogue. All of us were Gentiles. And they let us in the synagogue. And then the guy that, you know, he kind of escorts us to our seat. And then all he does is hand you a siddur, which was so kind of him. But the problem was, they're not talking in English. And they're speed reading Hebrew. So, you know, you got this whole line of Gentiles standing there with a siddur that some of them didn't have even turned the right way. And they're trying to figure out where in the world we're at in this siddur. I think I fared a little bit better than most. When I got to Lachad Odi, I was doing all right. I knew where I was at now. Okay, but you see what I'm saying? Here's Cornelius. You know, you walk him into the synagogue, you put him in the back of the synagogue, and you hand him a siddur. They didn't really necessarily have a siddur. But nonetheless, you know, does he know what he's doing? He doesn't know what he's doing. But it looks like when you get to Acts chapter 10 and you hear the story of this man saying these prayers, that he does know what's going on. He has been educated to some level about this. So would you say that he is one of the Gentiles turning towards God? I would.
I would. Very much say he was probably part of the northern kingdom of Israel.
Absolutely, why not? Sure. Absolutely, why not? I don't have any trouble with that. He could have been from anywhere. But yeah, absolutely, I don't have a problem with that. And as a matter of fact, let me say this. I struggled with this Gentile thing. I still struggle with it some, and I'm doing research right now that was written by a scholar on the particular subject, and he is not taking... He confines his work, his thesis, to Luke and Acts, okay? So, obviously, if you started reading in some other place, his material's not intended to be applicable outside of Luke and Acts. He's just trying to draw from Luke and Acts this particular situation. Now, I went to His Eminence, and I was talking to His Eminence about the Gentiles and the ones that we were looking for. And His Eminence said to me, and I'll never forget it, we're not just looking for any Gentile. So in other words, it's not just the first Gentile that you meet on the street. And then he said that basically, as Adon Gabriel is trying to suggest, that there are those that have the Nefesh Yehudi, and those are the ones that we are looking for. Now, to go beyond that at this particular moment is another story. We had a little bit of that discussion a couple of weeks ago, and we'll probably mount that again before long. And, of course, if you study Kabbalistic material, you will understand that God, in the beginning, you know, when it calls for Him to create light, He pours so much of Himself into the creation that it causes a fragmentation. And so they use vocabulary to describe this fragmentation, and they talk about sparks. I will use that phrase because it's much more appropriate, but they talk about sparks. And so the Kabbalistic idea is for us to redeem those sparks or find those sparks and then help them be brought back to the light. So, here's Adon Avner. He likes to fish. He's out on the Sea of Galilee. And, you know, he's waiting for the fish and waiting for the fish. Not a good day to be fishing. He isn't catching very many fish. And he's looking out toward the Golan. And he's looking out there, and he's looking at the water, and he's looking out there. And then he sees some shimmer of light in the distance on the Golan. What did he just see? He sees one of those fragments of light. And his job is... row, row, row your boat over to the...
Go to the light, go to the light.
Go to the light, okay? Go to the light. And then his job is to harvest that particular light. Now I'm going to present you with a couple of situations and something for you to think about. We know that Shammai, in the year 20 Common Era, BCE, before the Common Era, he makes 18 edicts. We don't have a copy of them, but we understand the significance and the difficulty of them from, I think it's Shabbat 15a, the Babylonian Talmud, Shabbat 15a. And it says that the day that he made those edicts was equal to, in infamy, to the day of the creation of the golden calf. And I think I can do this. Go to chapter 10 of Acts. This is again our story about Cornelius. And now Hochamsfet has been brought to Cornelius. And he said, verse 28, and I'm at chapter 10, verse 28. Then he said to them, "You know how it is unlawful for a Jewish man to keep company with or to go to one of another nation." Now, all you lawyers, Torah lawyers, and legal scholars, I would ask you, where did Hochamsfet find in the Torah that he could not associate with a Gentile? It's not there. There's no place in the Torah where it says that a Jew and a Gentile cannot eat together. Or even pray together or whatever. Now, a Jew cannot go to the house of a Gentile and eat from the kitchen of the Gentile until it's kosher. But the Gentile could come to the house of the Jew, and as long as he wasn't bringing his barbecued ribs and whatnot, there's no reason why he can't come to my house and eat from my house. I had a rabbi come to my house and I wanted him to eat. I wasn't going to serve him dinner because I didn't think he would eat dinner in my house. I'm a Gentile and my utensils were not clean, etc. But I wanted him to not come in and spend some time with me and not to have something to share. So I purchased some bottles of Coca-Cola, some bags of potato chips, and on and on and on. Everything had a hexer on it. Everything had a hexer. Nothing was unopened. Nothing had been opened. So he can come and look at a bag of Lay's potato chips, see the hexer on the Lay's potato chips, and say, "Look, you know, we can have some Lay's potato chips." And the easy way to deal with the dishes is paper. So he comes and he said, "Do you mind if I have a Coca-Cola? Please help yourself. Can I have some potato chips? Help yourself." So there was nothing wrong with this rabbi coming to my house, and I had prepared so that he would know that I wasn't trying to, you know, tell him, "Hey, yeah, I got this kosher home." I offered him something in a way that he could have those foods. So there was no law that said that he could not go to the Gentile's house. In Greek, this tells me that there was a dogma. A dogma is not a Torah mitzvah. A dogma is a man-made rule. So, what man-made rule was Hochamsfet alluding to? Something in one of those 18 edicts caused him to be at a place that he thought that he could not associate with the Jew, or excuse me, with the Gentiles. But if you read the very end, and this is the revelation of the whole vision, trance that he was in, he said, "But God has shown me that I should not call any man common or unclean." So the man is not unclean. A Gentile is not unclean. If he's unclean, it doesn't mean that, you know, we can't associate with one another. If he's going to participate in temple worship, then he has to go to the mikveh, etc. Okay, but here, this, of course, was what came from the vision that had been lowered in the tallit, etc. Now, I'm going to say it like this, and then I'm going to close, because this is at the point of research where we're at in the research we are doing with regards to the Gentiles, etc. And I pointed out to you last week, not last week, the week before last, the book by Lloyd Gaston. A very good book. It answers many, many questions that are considered to be kind of taboo in certain circles. But the question arises now as to whether the Jews, the Jewish people in the first century, were taught by God to evangelize, or were they taught to naturalize? So, by saying that they were taught to naturalize, it means, obviously, that they weren't interested in going outside of Eretz Israel. And by saying, were they taught to evangelize, would imply that they would have to go outside of Eretz Israel to look for souls, etc. So I'm going to leave you with that particular question on your brain. And we will pick up with that question and that idea as we continue through Romans, because Romans and even Yaakov should be giving you a hint, although I told you that the source material was in Acts and Luke. But you know how Jews are. You tell them that it's right here, and they're not going to just stay right there. They're going to go somewhere else to find an answer as well. Okay? Questions or comments?
Are you trying to call me bald-headed?
No. No. I'm not bald-headed. I just don't have as much hair on my head as I used to. You see that? See, I wear this hat like this, and then nobody knows, see?
Your Eminence?
Yes, ma'am?
Rabbi Haggai was teaching us on the Peshat level, I think. He said the way to look at it in Ramez was to see that it was alluding to hospitality as the mental level.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he said that it was related to Sodom and Gomorrah, and that they were, the servants were selfish.
Yeah.
The servant, this piece does what he wanted to.
Right.
But he said that we always have to give our minds room for other points of view in order to not become that way.
Right.
Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, you are given a truth, and it's something that you've never heard before. Does that mean immediately you reject it, or even immediately you accept it? And the
No. And the
answer to the question is, you know, if you haven't learned the lesson of why we eat the particular animals that we eat, and they're called kosher, then you don't know allegory at all. Okay? Because why would God say that you have to eat meat that is from an animal that has a cloven hoof or a divided hoof, and it chews the cud? So what's the remez? What is the allegory? What is the answer to this question? Why do they have a divided hoof? Why do they have a divided foot?
Able to discern right from wrong.
Okay, so there's more than one side to a thing. There's a right side and there's a wrong side. Or there's this view and there's that view. So you have to differentiate between, is that Hillel or is that Shammai? Okay? And so the other thing is, you know, how come he talks about an animal that has to chew its cud? What does it mean to chew the cud? We'll use the politically correct word, regurgitate. What does that mean?
I was going to say ruminate.
Ruminate. Regurgitate.
Regurgitate, yeah.
Yeah, you spit it back up. So, here you've been sitting for the last hour plus, and you've heard a lesson. Are you supposed to just go away saying, oh, wasn't that wonderful, you know, he told us all these things? Or are you supposed to say, no, wait a minute, how does that apply to this, and is that this, and... You have to bring it back up, regurgitate it, and chew on it again and again and again. Until you agree. You don't have to agree. You can disagree. I'm right, but it doesn't mean that... look, the Jewish people always say it, you know, two Jews, three synagogues. So, you know, you get two of them together and, you know, the first 2 minutes, you know, they're telling who they are, and then the next 3 minutes, you know, they're fighting over something. But it's important to even understand this simple thing. You know, the food tells you the story. Why do we eat that particular animal, etc.? So, once you understand those things, then you can say, I'm supposed to bring this up and think about it. I'm not supposed to just swallow it. And some guy comes along and tries to sell you a Ferrari, and it looks like a Volkswagen Beetle. Now, if he says he wants to sell you a Porsche that looks like a Volkswagen Beetle, you better look under the hood. Because Mr. Porsche invented the Beetle. So. Okay, any other questions or comments? Okay. Again, I thank all of you for your...